much. Great. Well, thank you for the opportunity to talk. When we fixed this topic and this date, it was in the probably naive hope and assumption that we might actually have resolved some of the interminable uncertainties that have attached themselves to the Brexit process over the last 3.5 years. But of course, that hasn't happened, and we still don't know exactly where we are on much of this. As you will, I'm sure, have seen, we're now mid-election campaign, and this is the third general election we've had in Britain since 2015, which is very unusual. On top of which, of course, we also had the European referendum in 2016. So most people, even professional observers of the political system, I mean, I work in the politics department at the University of Sheffield, I think are fairly united, at least on one point, which is that they're pretty sick of the whole thing, wherever they started out, leave or remain. But we're now midway through an election. There's going to be a general election on the 12th of December. And we'll see whether that brings any further clarity to the impasse that has really afflicted this whole process over the past 2 years. I have a sneaking suspicion that what we may end up with is not actually that far from where we were before the election, i.e. a hung parliament and an inability to resolve the thing for even longer. But we will see. But I'm not going to try and sort of diagnose the whole Brexit debate, because I'm sure others are better placed to do that. And you know, I'm sure even out over here follow some of this in the general coverage. I wanted to talk instead about the relationship between the Brexit moment in UK history and politics, and what it says about relationships between evidence, expertise, politics, and the public, and whether, as is often, I think, in a rather lazy way portrayed in a sort of discussion of these issues, Brexit, Trump, whether these things are symbolic of some bigger reversal of what perhaps some of us saw as a gentle upward trend towards more enlightened, evidence-informed decision-making and democracy. And then linked to that, I want to end by talking a bit about the specifics of this science system and where we stand with respect to funding for science after Brexit, if Brexit happens. And also wider issues for sort of collaboration between the UK research system and both the rest of the Europe and the wider world. So the two bits are linked, but I'll sort of start with the expertise stuff, which is probably the most interesting. You see there Nigel Farage, whose fingerprints run through all of this story. So I mean, British politics, a bit like here in New Zealand, with Peter here in the front row. I mean, in general, and of course there are ups and downs, and there are examples in both directions, but in general, the story we've told ourselves in British policy making, in academic policy studies in the UK over the last 25 years, certainly, is one of the gradual growth in use of evidence in plural forms, and the gradual strengthening of various institutional structures to enable that to happen. So just as Peter was your first chief scientist here in New Zealand, we have had an office of the chief scientist since the mid-60s, and it's really grown in strength, and the spread of science advisors across government has increased quite markedly since the mid-late 1990s, and with that various other structures. We've seen a growing role for scientific institutions and other learned societies, academic bodies like the Royal Society, where I used to work, in a whole range of policy debates. They're much more vocal and sort of proactive in policy discussions than they were 20, 30 years ago. And then, of course, we've got lots of other voices in the broader evidence policy landscape, not only from the natural sciences and engineering, but from economics, influential think tanks like the Institute for Fiscal Studies, bodies like the Institute for Government, who've been very active on Brexit debates, not taking a determined position pro or anti-leave or remain, but rather just getting into the real thicket of constitutional and governance and policy issues that would attach themselves to, and are attaching themselves to, the process of decoupling the UK from Europe after 40 years. And then other things like What Works Centres, the Behavioural Insights Unit, you know, all of these coming from slightly different disciplinary and methodological starting points, but bringing a whole variety of forms of evidence into policy processes. So that's been the sort of general story, and it sort of has transcended left and right. I mean, it carried on, you know, quite a lot of this sort of stuff was put in place during the New Labour era in under Tony Blair, etc., but had carried on then under David Cameron. So it wasn't seen as hugely partisan. When it came to the lead-up to the actual referendum in 2016, all of these bodies, whether they were coming from the sciences or from economics or from business, were united in making the case to stay inside the European Union. I mean, it really was a very, very sort of solid alliance of these sorts of bodies. Even to the extent that you had these sorts of adverts appearing in the British press in a great long... I don't quite know what thinking went into this kind of mode of advertising. I don't think it's particularly effective, but particularly when people say, well, if only there were more, you know, you think, well, would adding a few more names actually have made any difference? But anyway, you had these sort of double-page spreads, you know, a great long list. You can't read the categories from Nobel laureates, academics, business leaders, etc. So, you know, all of this accumulated sort of weight of the expert establishment, if you like, was lined up pretty much on one side of the argument. I mean, there were the odd, you know, random rogue economists and the odd, very few rogue scientists. I mean, the Leave lobby set up a sort of front organisation called Scientists for Britain, which was, I think, led by a sort of retired electrical engineer in Croydon or something from his back bedroom. And he didn't have any, you know, had no actual scientists involved, but they did at least try and make the pretense that there were scientists on both sides of the argument. Nature did a poll at one point of academic researchers and I think found 93-94% were in favour of remaining in the European Union. So that was the sort of position that, and of course, you know, you think back to that period leading up to the referendum. I mean, until very, very near to the final moment, it did look as if the Remain case was going to win. And of course, at the political level, you'd had that degree of complacency from David Cameron and others that had prompted the whole, you know, exercise in the first place. And then, of course, we know what happened. Oh, well, the other thing I'll mention, of course, is this famous, what became famous, intervention by the then Justice Secretary. He's now the minister in charge, was until the election, the minister in charge of our preparations for leaving the European Union, Michael Gove, who in an interview on Sky News came out with this remark about people in this country having had enough of experts. And this quote was picked up and amplified as somehow symbolising and embodying some sort of broader shift that was underway in the British body politic. And I think, you know, he in part intended it to be heard in that way. At the same time, it was a little bit unfair in that the full quote he used was, you know, people in this country had enough of experts in organisations with, you know, long acronyms as their name coming up with economic predictions. So he was really talking about bodies like the OECD and, you know, a quite sort of specific category, and he was really directing it at economic forecasting as a science. And of course, you know, there is a legitimate methodological debate about the you know, extent to which economic forecasters have or haven't predicted accurate outcomes. Nonetheless, this was seen obviously as a sort of signifying something broader. And then, of course, the thing itself happened. And, you know, reactions split predictably along the Leave Remain lines. You have the sort of pro-Brexiteer reaction to the vote, you know, take a bow, Britain, we've all risen up against this arrogant, out-of-touch political class. And of course, the experts were then included in that category. The kind of more straight line of, well, it's a big earthquake, it's changed Britain. Of course, Prime Minister resigned the next morning. And then very quickly, the question posed very well there by the Daily Mirror, so what the hell happens now? To which we haven't yet come up with an answer, 3.5 years on. So it was, as well as signifying, obviously, an enormous disruptive shock to the established political economic order and legal order in the UK, this outcome also posed a major crisis, in a sense, for all of those experts who'd lined up on those adverts and elsewhere in making their position. And I think, did provoke and does still provoke a great deal of soul-searching among those groups, at least among the more reflective of those groups, as to what it is that all of this signifies about where expertise and evidence stand. And it's that I want to just sort of reflect on a bit in my remarks, really. If we go first to this famous Michael Gove quote, has the public really had enough of experts? But there you see the full quote. I think people in this country have enough of experts from organisations with acronyms saying that they know what's best and getting it consistently wrong. And in making that remark, he did speak to, a genuine public scepticism towards a lot of expert prediction from various directions, allied to which the Leave campaign, of course, had very effectively marshalled this very powerful, potent language of taking back control, of reasserting sovereignty in an inchoate but very persuasive way in terms of public opinion. And now, of course, in British government, at least up until the election, and it looks most likely that they will be returned into government, we have the very same people who ran that Leave campaign leading the government. So it's a sort of interesting and perhaps slightly alarming turn. Of course, there's been a lot of work done by political scientists looking at actually what went on in the EU referendum vote, and I won't summarise all of that now, and you'll be familiar with much of it. But some really important work that has been done and continues to be done, particularly by research programmes like the Britain in the EU programme that Amon Menon at King's College London directs, which has marshalled, I think, very high quality in general social science, political science work on the referendum itself and then on all of the consequences of Brexit in all sorts of different sectors afterwards. But what the kind of analysis done really brings to the surface is the extent to which, of course, people were voting not on the actual structures of governance within the European Union or the European Commission, but were voting on membership of the EU as a proxy for a whole load of other concerns and differences in values, which split quite neatly down the Leave-Remain divide, and you see it here in terms of people's attitude to things like multiculturalism, feminism, environmentalism, globalisation, the internet, capitalism, immigration, so the yellow here are people who voted to remain, the blue are people who vote to leave. So how do people who thought these things were a force for good vote? Those that saw multiculturalism, immigration, globalisation as a force for good tended to vote to remain. Those that saw them as a force for ill tended to vote to leave. There's other stuff going on as well, but that broadly is the kind of split that we saw. There was, of course, a demographic distinction as well that was very marked. So among 18 to 24-year-olds, 73% voted to remain. When you come up to 65-year-olds, 60% voted to leave. And there was a geographic distribution as well. In general, of course, Scotland and Wales voted to remain. Much of the southeast, the prosperous part of England voted Romaine, and then the middle north of England, basically all the peripheral parts of England, voted to leave. The city where I live, Sheffield, voted to leave. And then another interesting thing in terms of linking it to debates about expertise is the extent to which a degree education was also a factor in whether people voted to remain or leave. And I mean, in some ways, none of this is that surprising, but it was certainly, I think, you know, in some of the sort of generic comments that are made about what the vote meant, some of these details are often glossed over or elided. And of course, at a political level, one of the most frustrating things about debates since the referendum has been the extent to which what was obviously a very slender majority, 52-48 across the country as a whole, has been taken as a mandate for all sorts of things that, I mean, A, weren't on the ballot paper, and B, you know, are highly debatable in terms of actual levels of public support. So this was most acute when we got to the point where it really looked, just a few months ago, like we might be heading for a so-called no-deal Brexit, leaving without any agreement whatsoever with Europe, and no end of political leaders, including our Prime Minister, claiming, you know, 17.4 million people, a majority, voted for that, when, of course, the very same people were telling the country in the lead-up to the referendum that that was an impossible outcome. He even said himself, Johnson, this is in the period when he was standing for election to leader of the Conservative Party, that it was a one-in-a-million chance. So huge amounts of shifting of goalposts going on in all of this that makes, again, the sort of, I guess, heightens the frustration among those sections of the of society, academics and others who at least like to cling to some kind of notion of a rational, evidence-informed basis to decision-making. It's made it a very kind of frustrating and difficult environment. You know, at the same time, I think, as I say, the more reflective voices within academia and elsewhere have actually taken a step back and tried to reflect on why it is that all of those serried ranks of experts lined up on one side of the debate made no difference whatsoever. And there's a lovely piece here. This actually comes from Amon Menon originally, but it's been written about here by Aditya Chakraborty, who's a very good journalist in The Guardian. But I'll just sort of read out, it'd be too hard to read from the back, but so he's saying here, there's a lady I've been thinking about for the past few days, even though we've never met. She's the central character in a true story told by the Europe expert Amon Menon. Amon Menon, so he was at King's. He was in Newcastle just before the referendum to debate the impact of Britain leaving the EU. Invoking the gods of economics, the King's College London professor invited the audience to imagine the likely plunge in the UK's GDP that would result from a Leave vote. Back yelled the woman, "That's your bloody GDP, not ours." And of course, at one level, that's absurd because it's all our GDP. But at another level, that really is the thing we're dealing with here. It's the gulf, the division that's grown up between the aggregate, if you like, the macroeconomic picture, and the local and the particular picture. And really, it's that that runs through this story. It's a gulf and a gap that I think still, as a country, we're not really much closer to addressing. One of the great tragedies of the constitutional farce that we have lived through and continue living through, again, wherever you started out in this debate, is that it's become an enormous distraction from actually tackling the kinds of frustrations, the social dislocation, the inequality, the knock-on effects of austerity that was imposed in the wake of the global financial crisis that you see reflected in that kind of, excuse me, in that kind of reaction from the now, yeah, mythical, well, not mythical, she was real, but the woman in Newcastle. There's a huge amount bound up in that, that we have not really had the political space, time and opportunity to address. And I guess at some point we'll get to that, but a general election, again, is another way of kicking it into the long grass for at least a few more months. So there's a lot going on in all of this. And the only other aspect, of course, in lurking in the background is the, you know, influence, large or small, of more malign actors. I mean, I personally think this stuff is probably exaggerated as a significant factor in the actual outcome of the referendum. I don't think it's exaggerated in the extent it didn't happen. I think clearly there is quite a lot of evidence of this sort of social media activity, Russian influence, etc., etc. But I kind of have my doubts as to whether it was a significant enough factor in the mix to really swing the result one way or another. I don't know. There is a detailed parliamentary inquiry that's been conducted into this, which the government has now, which was ready to be published a few weeks ago, and the government has just suppressed ahead of the election. So we won't know what it says until after after the government that worked with these people is back in power. So it's a bit more like America in this sense. So, of course, all of this has also fed into this kind of narrative about post-truth, which we'll all be familiar with. And there's been no end of books and articles and commentators talking about Brexit. And as I say, very often pairing it with Donald Trump and seeing these two and other events in other countries as somehow signifying a post-truth moment or a shift towards a more post-truth contoured environment for politics. I mean, there's lots of debates, there's lots to unpick here. I mean, I kind of personally have my reservations about this. I certainly have my reservations about the ahistoricity of sort of pretending this stuff started to happen in Britain in June 2016 and didn't happen in various ways before over long periods. There definitely have been aspects of the post-Brexit period in Britain. I'm not going to talk about Donald Trump, but if I focus on Britain, there have been moments in the post-referendum period where it really did feel that we were somehow sliding into very dangerous territory politically and in terms of the sort of wider public discourse around the EU. And I mean, this sort of stuff, when we had newspaper headlines denouncing judges as enemies of the people, again, the period, as I say, which I haven't got a slide on, where it looked like we were going to no deal, you'll recall earlier in the summer, not long after he'd been, he wasn't elected Prime Minister, before he'd become Prime Minister through votes inside the Conservative Party, Boris Johnson, of course, prorogued the British Parliament for this very long period. And that was another moment that felt much more alarming in terms of the kind of signals and warning bells that those sorts of things ring in terms of the overall health of our democracy. So there have been moments like this, but you know, we have to remember the Daily Mail is not, thank God, representative of the actual views of the population at large. And I think, as always, there's a need to take a slight deep breath before we sort of, you know, write the funeral rites for you know, democracy in Britain or elsewhere. Personally, I'm much more sympathetic to those attempts to try and make sense of this in a rather more nuanced way. And I was just going to mention a couple of these. I'm sure some of you will be very familiar with this stuff. But just a couple of people who I think have got a bit closer than the sort of those who are really ringing the banging the gong for post-truth. One account I really like is this book by Will Davis, who's a young, great, well, I say young, he's a great, I mean, he's the same sort of age as me, but he's a really interesting, thoughtful political economist, political sociologist. And he published this book in the middle of last year about the rise of feeling and sentiment in politics and how this is one of the things that's actually lies behind things like the Brexit vote and lies behind the so-called post-truth shift. But he would also be a bit hesitant to use that. So, again, I won't read all of this out, but it is relevant to the debate about experts. He says here, in the context of rising populism and accompanying syndromes that are denounced as, quote, post-truth or tribalism, it's common to blame political turbulence on voters giving vent to their feelings. A lot of the criticism of populism, you know, rests on these kind of critiques. But telling people to keep their emotions in check and bow down before their more rational superiors is scarcely an appealing or effective message. To criticise populists and their supporters in these terms is to avoid confronting the much larger question of why feeling might have become a more important navigational aid in the 21st century. Rather than criticise people for a lack of self-control, how might we understand the historical transition that's turned feeling into such a potent political force? And again, you think of the woman in Newcastle, you know, it's your bloody GDP. This is the kind of thing he's trying. So he's really pushing for us to reflect more deeply on the kinds of economic and political dislocation that lie behind these things, rather than to take things like post-truth at face value. Similarly, a lot of interesting reflection on this from within STS, Social Studies of Science. I mean, I was trained originally in STS, and STS itself as a discipline has come in for a fair amount of criticism in both the US and in Europe as somehow having contributed to this sort of post-truth, you know, the sort of post-modernism leading to post-truth and a sort of slipperiness when it comes to facts. And it's provoked a really interesting sort of debate within the discipline, certainly the STS discipline, with lots of discussion and, you know, papers to and fro, particularly in the journal Social Studies of Science. But one of the most thoughtful reactions, again, to this, I think, came from Sheila Jasanoff and Hilton Simit, her colleague, STS scholar at Harvard. Again, just encouraging us to really take a step back and be a bit more critical in the way we discuss the so-called post-truth moment, and an argument that what it does more than anything is shows us that neither facts nor values can stand alone in a government founded on principles of truthfulness and inclusive public debate. And without renewed attention to the norms that shape the practices of public science and public reason, Sheila Jasanoff's been involved over the last 15 years really in this sort of project of thinking about public reason, it won't be possible to guide fortune's wheel, guide the future expertly along the arc of justice. So lots of good stuff for reflection. When it comes to the specificity of Brexit and science and evidence, I mean, this is a sort of summary, I guess, of what I think about this. Yes, I mean, it's clear that the sorts of easy assumptions that I started out with, that we're sort of on this gentle upward trend towards greater use of evidence in policy and a more evidence-informed democracy, definitely those assumptions have taken a knock. One of the reasons I'm here in Auckland these 2 weeks, Peter and I are working on a book together on scientific advice and evidence in policy, and the fact that that book's taken us 3 years is a reflection, really. We started out with one set of arguments that kind of got knocked sideways a bit by this stuff, and we've had ourselves, both as academics and as practitioners, particularly in Peter's case, to reflect, I think, quite deeply on what all of this means for the sorts of arguments that we would like to make. But, you know, I certainly see it less as a crisis of truth or a crisis of expertise and more a crisis of democracy, and this is in line with the sorts of things that Jasanoff and Will Davis and others would say. So really, if what we're interested in doing is not simply proving ourselves right and them, whoever they are, wrong, which is still a very dominant trope in UK political discussion, I mean, the degree of polarisation between the Leave and Remain camps, as I'm sure you'll be aware, is fairly acute now, and there's little, you know, in immediately after the referendum, there was a bit more of a period in which people said, well, actually, you know, we need to think why it is that people voted this way and what this tells us, and, you know, why we therefore need to think more about inequality. And you know, as I say, a very strong regional dimension. If you live in the north of England like I do, there was a lot of discussion about north-south imbalances, etc. And that does flare up from time to time. It's there again now because we're in the middle of an election campaign, but there hasn't been enough of the giving ground on either side. But if we're actually interested in trying to repair some of this, I think our starting point shouldn't be to dismiss populist movements based on feeling, in Will Davis's terms, nor to reassert the self-evident superiority of rational decision-making or of us as experts, but to start instead by repairing our democratic institutions and the cultures that support them. And I think on the part of the science community and the expert community more largely, if one can think of it as a community, we need to firstly be more humble about this and to acknowledge that we as a community have too often uncritically aligned ourselves with the winners at the expense of the losers in these same debates, to go back to our woman in Newcastle and whose GDP. And you know, I often think about this article in Nature, which was just a simple comment piece. I know Peter also uses this from time to time, by a guy called Colin McElwain, and he was writing here about US politics and the prospect then, still in the future, as it were, of Donald Trump becoming president. But you know, it was also several months before the EU referendum, and really just provoking the science community to reflect more on the fact that we have not stood up enough for the losers in either society, in the US or UK. And so it wouldn't be that surprising if, you know, when we then expect the public to line up alongside us, they don't necessarily do so. So, and of course, this was written before both of those things happened. I think it's quite a prescient piece. So we've ended up now in a situation where I say things are quite polarised. The university sector generally is seen still as very much on the Remain side of the argument. And that's created problems politically for the higher education sector in the UK over the last 2-3 years. You know, we're definitely sort of as a sector kind of out of step, as it were, with where the government is. And if, of course, Boris Johnson's re-elected, that will continue to be the case. It's something, all of this, as I say, we've thought a lot about in the context of the kind of work we do on science advice and in the INGSA network that Peter chairs and that I'm involved in and several others in the room are involved in. So, you know, I think it's, in a positive sense, you know, we need to continue taking these sorts of episodes as food and as stimulus for deeper, more critical reflection about these debates and how we navigate through them, either as academics or, as I say, as practitioners and as policymakers. But you know, for the UK science community, for the UK higher education community, it is a very difficult period. And I wanted to sort of end pulling back from the evidence stuff into some stuff about sort of the actual nuts and bolts of science collaboration, which is the other sort of side of this. And the one that gets, I guess, more day-to-day attention within the academic and science community, which is itself a bit of a shame because, of course, going back to what I was saying earlier, if one's diagnosis as to the root causes of all of this are to do with economic inequality, social breakdown, social dislocation of various kinds, clearly those problems are unlikely to be solved by simply clawing a few more grants back into the university system that might be lost as a result of Brexit. It's a rather superficial response. Nonetheless, it is important, and it's the thing that does get the most attention in terms of the science side. The other thing, of course, is mobility of people and the status of academics within all of those debates. But on the science funding side, you know, we have, of course, benefited as the UK research system over many years now from the collaborative funding structures that exist at a European level. You'll see here, this was the last international research strategy the government published. 13 of the top 20 countries that the UK collaborates with on co-author publications are in Europe. There are very dense collaborative networks that have been sustained as a result of European funding. We, as the UK, have generally done very well, often done the best within the EU member states in terms of funding under various European mechanisms. And we've certainly kind of got back from Europe more research funding than we've put in as a proportion of our overall contribution over quite a number of years. So it's a significant part. It's about something in the order of £800 million a year that come into UK universities and researchers from European sources. So the loss of all of that in a sort of hard Brexit, no deal scenario is pretty significant. There's been lots of discussion over the course of the last 2 years about how we move forward with science in the context of the bigger debate about Brexit, various you know, papers and proposals from all sides, from the government, from the university system, from national academies and others, and lots of warnings kind of growing in volume. I mean, this goes back to 2017, but it's also 2017, but kind of growing in volume over this period from the sector about the harm that would be done by, well, by any form of Brexit, but particularly by a sort of hard Brexit. Wellcome Trust, one of our biggest biomedical funders, has been particularly active in trying to construct a more sort of positive agenda for EU-UK research collaboration after Brexit. So not trying to rerun the referendum, which some people in the university system are still trying to do, but rather to get onto the nuts and bolts of how we preserve what's most valuable in EU-UK scientific collaboration in a post-Brexit environment. And I mean, as well as the funding side, there's also all of the aspects of the use of science in policy, where again, there's a huge amount of UK-EU links, and the increasing role of Europe as a rule maker, as a standard setter in international science, as in many other areas. And this is a piece that Sarah de Rijker, a Dutch colleague, and I wrote for Nature just 3 or 4 months ago on this topic, kind of looking at that role of Europe in international science. Not simply as a source of money, but as a source of norms as to how we do science in the 21st century. And so you look at debates like open access and the role of things like Plan S now as a way of approaching open research. You look at approaches to open data, all sorts of debates where Europe has become a very strong collective force. And it's a challenge for the UK, having been right at the centre of those debates, as to how we proceed when we're no longer inside Europe. In general, this piece from the FT sort of sums up where we're at. The UK science can still take nothing for granted post-Brexit, because until we know where we are on the bigger questions of what kind of agreement, well, A, do we manage to have a deal with Europe? And I mean, although Boris Johnson came close, as it were, to getting a deal through Parliament before the election, there's still a lot of scenarios in which that could unravel post-election. So, you know, we're not sort of even there to the point of having a definite deal. No deal is still a possibility. He's been saying again this week that he will definitely not extend the transition period beyond the end of 2020, which would again default to a no deal position. But, you know, even if we get a deal, of course, that's just the beginning. This is the stupid thing about the whole debate. You know, the deal is sort of fetishized as if it's the thing, and the deal is simply the thing that gets us out. We then have to spend the next... Well, if you believe the government, we'll spend the next 12 months agreeing the fastest ever trade deal with Europe in the history of humanity. If you believe all the people who actually spend their life doing trade negotiations with Europe, it'll take at least sort of 3 to 5 years. So we'll see. Somewhere in the mix of all of that, an agreement has to be forged around science. But clearly, you can't assume a swift resolution of the science piece of what's a very, very complicated, you know, 5,000-piece jigsaw puzzle. The science piece will sort of get addressed in time. And it's a great shame, because science is one of the things where, in essence, on both sides, the European side and the UK side, there is in general, at the political level and obviously at the scientific level among, you know, universities and researchers, a real willingness and enthusiasm, indeed, to try and preserve linkages. So in a way, it just becomes victim of the wider trend. There is this weird sort of contradictional paradox in the UK government position on science. You know, on the one, the present government, this is, on the one hand, they're you know, single-handedly engaged in dismantling the greatest structure for collaborative research that the world has ever created through the European framework, or at least, you know, dismantling our involvement in it, which is, of course, very damaging. On the other side, they're also talking up science like, you know, I can't remember a government really in recent times that has talked as positively about research funding, at least particular types of research funding. So you get all of this kind of stuff after, but this is people inside Number 10, after Brexit, science is Number 10's top priority. They've got big, ambitious plans to spend more at a national level on science, which would be necessary, of course, to compensate, not least for the loss of funding from the European Union. And all sorts of plans to create new funding structures, you know, I mean, very, you know, very much in line with wider Brexiteer thinking. The inspiration they're seeking for new structures is, of course, the US and things like DARPA, which, you know, was a defence research projects agency that was sort of set up at the height of the Cold War in the United States. It seems to most of us who are actual research policy, you know, I study research systems for a living, as it were, a very odd period of history to sort of focus on and elevate as your template for Britain in the 21st century. But there is lots of talk. We'll see what happens. Meanwhile, what's actually happening, of course, because of this prolonged uncertainty is that in the absence of a deal of any kind, or in the absence of even leaving, because we're still, of course, part of Europe at the moment, we're just gradually seeing the whole thing unravel as a matter of, you know, inertia and entropy or whatever in these systems. So this data came out from the Royal Society just 3 weeks ago, in the middle of October. And this is actual data on current funding levels. So within the existing European program, Horizon 2020, our annual share has already fallen by €500 million since the referendum. There's been a 40% drop in UK applications to Horizon 2020. We're now seeing 35% fewer scientists coming to the UK from the rest of Europe through the main scheme. So these are very, very marked changes in the picture already. And going back to my previous slide, even in a scenario where we get some kind of deal for science down the road, it's likely to be after a gap of 2, 3, 4 years. So one can only assume that these trends are going to continue. Indeed, they're going to actually accelerate because we'll be formally outside of these structures. So it's quite a sort of depressing picture, really. The final thing I'll mention, I'll wrap up in a second. I mean, this has happened. This says July in 2019, but this report actually came out this last week while I've been in New Zealand. But this is a review that's been done by a guy called Adrian Smith, who's a big figure in UK science research, looking at the future of UK science collaboration across the world, so not just in Europe, but also, you know, in other parts of the world, post-Brexit. Well worth a read if you're interested in this stuff. And they're grappling really with the dilemma of whether, you know, in the context of the uncertainty, the persistent uncertainty, to what extent should the UK system seek to proactively create new funding structures for international collaboration, both with Europe, with the other European countries, and with other parts of the world, or you know, should we sort of hold back and wait to resolve the European question? They're in essence essentially starting to push for the former, us pushing ahead and doing stuff on our own, because that actually becomes quite quickly the pragmatic way forward in this situation, because it's going to take so long for the other stuff to sort out. So there's lots of discussion. I think Nature sums it up well. This was an editorial again just from a couple of weeks ago in the context of the UK election that had just been called. Beware the UK government's Brexit promises. I think that's the general mood within the university system, that we, amongst all of the other erosions of trust and confidence and civility in British politics and British society more generally, one very marked decline is can be seen in sort of academic attitudes towards the trustworthiness of politicians, almost from either side, as we said, of the left-right spectrum. And what you see more than anything else are academics, universities as institutions, and to some extent the country as a whole, hedging against all of these uncertainties. So, I mean, that report I just mentioned in the previous slide is really a very sophisticated, erudite, and, you know, 59-page long hedge against not knowing what the hell's happening and trying to sort of come up with ways forward. At an individual level, many academics are, you know, those who do a lot of work with Europe, and of course that's many of us. You know, I mean, I speak personally for a minute. I mean, I, you know, 20% of my salary comes from European research projects. That's quite normal in UK social science. And you've got lots of collaborative networks that you've had for many years with colleagues and partners in other European countries. So many of us are sort of hedging against whatever might happen, you know, developing fallback offers for part-time posts at other European universities, claiming, you know, passports where you can, you know, more UK citizens on the mainland, as it were, of Great Britain are eligible for Irish citizenship than actually live on the island, you know, island of Ireland, because of their rather generous rules of citizenship down the generation. So my long-dead grandfather, who died in 1987, has, from beyond the grave, bequeathed me a passport, which I just got the other day with great, you know, at least I managed to get it before we finally left. So, you know, people are all doing these kind of things, you know, individuals, research groups, and then, of course, universities, they're opening up branch campuses in Berlin and Paris and all sorts of stuff going on. And it's a massive time suck, all of this, really, if you take a step. I mean, it's a huge waste of time. So it's very easy to be pessimistic, whether on the sort of evidence and expertise and politics front or on the funding front. And I think all of us do slide into pessimism from time to time. At the same time, I think it is important not to overplay all of this and also not to give up on the prospects that we will somehow muddle our way through it to something better. And I've put up here in a rather sentimental final slide a picture of my three-year-old son, Ned, on an anti-no deal march that we went on a few months ago when it really looked like we were going out with no deal. So we took the kids to Manchester and we went on one of these marches. And I think, you know, going back to the demographic point, more than anything else, it's that will probably, at some point in the future, pull us back into a slightly better relationship with Europe and hopefully into a better relationship with science and expertise, because amidst everything else that's being lost by us leaving Europe, for our kids, it's the loss of being able to live and work in 28 other countries. It's the loss of all of that economic and social opportunity that I think will, I hope, still at some point pull my country back towards some semblance of normality. So I'll end on that very tense.